The General of Palestine's Islamic Jihad movement has hailed Iran's support for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip. And thousands of Israeli protesters once again take to the streets across the occupied territories, calling for early elections and the resignation of the regime's premier. Thank you for joining us. Today's top story, the Israeli military has launched new aerial and ground attacks on Gaza as a death toll from the nearly 6 months of onslaught on the besieged strips keeps climbing. Israeli warplanes have once again targeted the central city of Deir al-Balah as well as Rafah in the south. Civil defense crew and paramedics are struggling to recover the wounded from the bombed-out buildings due to lack of equipment. Heavy fighting is also underway in the vicinity of Al-Shifa Hospital, located in Gaza City. According to the Gaza Health Ministry, 82 people were killed in the last 24 hours, bringing the death toll to more than 32,700 since early October. Nearly 75,200 Palestinians have also been wounded. Most of the casualties are women and children. The Deputy Secretary General of Palestinian Islamic Jihad Movement noted that the Palestinian resistance has showed great resilience in the face of Israel's genocidal war in Gaza.
In the beginning of the battle, Israel expected that the Palestinians would lose. They carried out shelling and airstrikes against the residential areas in Gaza and thought that the war was over. But then they were forced to fight in the northern Gaza. And then they said they had defeated the resistance in Khan Yunis in the south, but later they found the presence of the Palestinian fighters there who fired rockets towards the Israeli enemy. Israel did not expect that the spirit of Palestinian resistance would be so high. They realized that the Palestinians in Gaza are ready to sacrifice and bear all the hardships in order to continue fighting.
Mohammed al-Hindi noted that Israel and the U.S. have failed to achieve any of their goals in their onslaught on the besieged territory. He added that Washington and Tel Aviv were after weakening the resistance. Al-Hindi said the Israeli regime has been using American weapons to destroy Gaza's infrastructure to forcibly displace Palestinians from their homes. The top Islamic Jihad official said that Israel seeks to divide Gaza into two parts and give control of the strip to another group. Al-Hindi stressed that the day after the end of the Israeli onslaught, Gaza will be under the full control of Palestinians. Now to talk more on this, we are joined by Mr. Shabir Rizvi, a political commentator from Chicago. Now, Mr. Rizvi, first of all, your thoughts on the Islamic Republic's support for the Palestinians and the Palestinian cause, and why do you think since the 1979 Islamic Revolution, Iran continues to support the Palestinian cause despite the numerous sanctions slapped on the nation? We know that it isn't the main reason for the sanctions, but it's part of it as it goes against the West policy and, most importantly, Zionism.
Yes, thank you for having me. The first day of the Islamic Revolution in 1979, Ayatollah Khomeini promised that Iran would step up for Palestine and would have full solidarity with the Palestinian cause. This was actually even reflected on by the leaders of the PIJ back then. I believe they came out with a booklet called The Islamic Solution and the Alternative, where they praised the Islamic Revolution in Iran and saw this as a light in an otherwise dark world for the Palestinian cause, that they now had a vehement ally behind them in order to fight the Zionist regime. And as you know, throughout the years, Iran has faced many sanctions, whether it is just for stepping up for itself or stepping up for Palestine. And the thing about this is Iran correctly points out that the Israeli regime, the Zionist regime, is a cancer on the region. What it does is it acts as a military outpost for the United States. This is going to, if left unchecked, it is going to grow. It's going to, you know, go into other territories. It poses an imminent threat to the entire region. Iran correctly analyzed this and saw what the Zionist regime is capable of on the behest of Western regimes, on the behest of Western imperialism. So in order for the region to be stabilized, in order for the region to see peace, Israel must be removed. It's as clear as day. as long as this illegitimate regime is allowed to stay in any sort of way, whether it's a two-state solution or what have you, it poses a direct threat to the region. The only way for the region to see any peace is the dissolution of Israel, is the overthrow of Israel, and Iran correctly sees that and correctly backs that.
World, Lynn, from the Iran's Islamic Revolution, especially now in this day and age, as we see the U.S.-Israeli onslaught on Gaza, especially being supported by the U.S., killing and destroying whoever or whatever is in their way.
Yes, yeah, so it's very unfortunate that it's coming down to this, the way that the Palestinian resistance is kind of able to respond to this is only because of the allyship of Iran and the tactics that Iran has taught it throughout the years, and also their own courageousness and their own tactics that they've learned throughout the years. What we're seeing on the battlefront right now is Palestinians still, over 6 months in, responding to Israeli threats, destroying Merkava tanks, destroying Zionist troops. 6 months later, and they're unable to stop the Palestinian resistance, to the point where the Palestinian resistance, even from the north, is able to send rockets into occupied Palestine, sending settlers running into their basements. The Israeli regime has been unable to stop the Palestinian resistance. And because of that, they're now resorting to killing civilians. They're, as they've always have been, they're resorting to these war crimes. They're resorting to starvation, especially in the month of Ramadan, which is just absolutely preposterous. And you see the true face of the Zionist regime, which many of us have seen throughout years, but now it's exposed to the international community that the Zionist regime is, in fact, this genocidal, illegitimate occupation. And even the international courts are seeing this. International appendages that once, you know, ignored Palestine are now forced to look at the Palestinian issue face to face and call out Israel for what it is. It's a pariah state. It's committing war crimes. It's committing the crime of genocide. All the while, it's unable to even achieve any of its political objectives, which include eliminating Hamas or disarming Hamas or what have you. They're unable to stop the Palestinian resistance. And of course, this speaks to years of experience of the resistance that was backed fundamentally by Iran since day one of Iran's Islamic Revolution. And I think that, you know, the praise that we see from the leaders of Hamas and PIJ for Iran is completely without question accurate. Iran has been there for their allies since day one, and I don't think that's going to go away at any point throughout history.
There you have it, Mr. Shabir Rizvi, political commentator from Chicago. Mr. Rizvi, thank you for your time, sir. Now, continuing with the rest of the news, the Palestinian resistance factions have rejected an Israeli proposal to send military forces of some Arab countries to manage the besieged Gaza Strip. In a statement issued by Hamas, the Palestinian factions warned of the consequences of such proposal, saying that it's a trap set by Tel Aviv and Washington to help Israel go around its defeat in Gaza. The factions added that the proposal seeks to draw some Arab countries into serving Israeli plans amid the regime's failures on the ground. The statement warned that any international or Arab forces entering Gaza would be considered an occupying force and will be dealt with accordingly. It also confirmed that the Palestinian people are capable of choosing their leaders and institutions to manage the besieged strip. The proposal was reported by American media, which claimed that Israel was seeking to deploy a multinational force in the besieged Gaza Strip. The Secretary General of Palestine's Islamic Jihad movement has hailed Iran's support for Palestinians in the Gaza Strip.
The Islamic Republic of Iran has paid the price of supporting Palestine with sanctions because of its position regarding the Palestinian defense and resistance and its support for the Palestinian people and its rights. But in recent years, what has distinguished the position of the Islamic Republic is its constant support of the Palestinian people, and it would have not been easy for the Palestinian people to have this blessed steadfastness in the Battle of Al-Aqsa flood without the Iranian continuous and clear support, which has been constant in recent years in the political, military, and security field.
Nakhale noted that Iran has always sided with justice and defended the Palestinian nation since the victory of the 1979 Islamic Revolution. Nakhale made the comments after meeting Iranian Foreign Minister Hossein Amir Abdollahian in Tehran. The two sides discussed the latest developments in Gaza and the ongoing Israeli onslaught against civilians in the Palestinian territory. The Palestinian official had previously held talks with senior Iranian officials. Thousands of Israeli protesters have once again taken to the streets demanding the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Massive rallies were held in Tel Aviv, Haifa, and the occupied Al-Quds. Protesters called on Netanyahu to immediately finalize a deal with the Palestinian resistance movements that would see the return of the captives being held in Gaza. They criticized Netanyahu for prioritizing his political interests in Gaza over the lives of the captives and demanded new elections. Opponents of the government and the families of the captives say they are also planning days-long and massive demonstrations in the coming week. Netanyahu has been in hot water as he is charged with fraud and breach of trust in a number of cases. Meanwhile, tens of thousands of protesters turned out at the 11th National Pro-Palestine demonstration in the British capital, London. Protesters are still frustrated at the lack of pressure being placed on Tel Aviv to avert more Palestinian lives being lost. Amina Taylor reports from London.
It was the 11th time the British capital had played host to another national demonstration against the US-led Israeli genocide of Palestinians inside Gaza. Coincidentally, this march was taking place on an auspicious day for Palestinians. March 30th is commemorated as Land Day to mark the 1976 Israeli killing of six Palestinians and the wounding of scores more who had gathered to show their affinity for a land that has literally witnessed the constant shedding of Palestinian blood. In an act of solidarity with Palestine, central London showed it would not be letting up on the pressure. Flash forward to this most recent attempt to ethnically cleanse Palestine of its people, and it's clear the UK is being blasted for its complicity in allowing a ceasefire motion to go unacknowledged by Tel Aviv. A comparatively small counter-demo by pro-Israel supporters was peacefully drowned out by pro-Palestinians. The protesters taking part in the demo had a variety of reasons why their presence on the marches mattered.
We just want to bring this conflict into the consciousness of everyone, so everyone understands what's going on here. You know, children being slaughtered, you know, women being slaughtered, schools and hospitals just completely destroyed. You know, it's just inhumane. It's just beyond imagination.
We have to stop this. We have to. Don't you? No one can be blind to what's happening. It has to stop. It has to stop. Showing ourselves like this, demonstrating how horrified and outraged we are, and then boycott Israel.
Demonstrators have pledged to keep turning out in the streets to protest against the genocide in Gaza until there's a cessation of violence and justice for Palestinians. Amina Taylor, London.
Protests were also held around France to mark the 48th annual commemoration of Palestinian Land Day. The West continues to extend total support for Tel Aviv despite the wanton violence of the Israeli regime, which has already violated the United Nations order for a ceasefire. Rami Mazari reports from Paris.
In Paris and across France, major rallies were held on Palestinian Land Day, which recalls the events of March 30th, 1976, when Israelis killed six unarmed Palestinians and injured 100 others during protests against Israel's confiscation of Palestinian land. The United Nations Security Council finally passed a resolution for a ceasefire in Gaza, but Israel continues to trample on the most basic human rights. Its main arms dealers and political bodyguards, the United States and Germany, have taken no steps to prevent Tel Aviv from murdering even more innocents. The casualty count in Gaza is now well over 100,000, with more than 32,000 Palestinians killed and 75,000 people injured in less than 6 months. Israel continues to do what it once virulently denied ever doing, illegally bombing hospitals, and even arresting scores of doctors and patients in just the last week. Despite spreading famine, Israel has told the United Nations it will not allow any food convoys into northern Gaza, which the UN Secretary General described as a moral outrage. An investigative report just revealed that a French arms company sent nearly a ton of machine gun parts to Israel in October, which were likely used against civilians in Gaza. That contradicts the longtime stance of Paris that the arms it exports to Israel are purely defensive. Christians in Gaza are celebrating their holy Easter weekend amid the invasion, carpet bombing, and famine. Hundreds of historical sites, including many churches, have been destroyed by Israelis in what's been deemed a cultural genocide. Ramin Mazahiri, Paris.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
This is the Heart of Life Pounding. IRIB English Radio.
The Zionist regime is building infrastructure to carve up Gaza, prevent the return of displaced Palestinians, and change the geographical and demographic facts on the ground. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for the second part, please. Middle East Eye wrote, Netanyahu's threats to storm Rafah and the Philadelphia corridor are likely a negotiation tactic to pressure and blackmail resistance groups and Egypt. Nonetheless, Israeli analysts insist that the Zionist regime's real strategic interests lie in northern Gaza and that a confrontation with Egypt may trigger a strategic dilemma. What this means is that there is no option for considering a comprehensive resolution to the war, but only for partial and temporary deals after which the war will continue, and where the Zionist regime does not withdraw and the displaced families do not return. At best, any discussion about the return of displaced people in Gaza will be insignificant and will not result in their actual return. In fact, before any ceasefire, the Zionist regime will have completed its system of control and cemented its colonial presence in Gaza. In other words, the Zionist regime is not carrying out a military campaign that will end with the end of this war. Palestinians and Arabs are too focused on negotiations or ceasefire talks and the Zionist regime's obstruction tactics. This results in a round-the-clock rush after details that constitute a series of distractions, while the Zionist regime's actions on the ground clearly reveal a return to its total occupation of Gaza and destruction as a single geographical unit for its people. The international community's fixation on humanitarian aid, while ignoring Israel's long-term plans, will further result in Palestinians' indefinite displacement. Another issue pertains to the floating dock proposal, which the White House claims will be used to deliver 2 million meals a day to Gaza. According to this plan, the Zionist regime is to take control of the security of the makeshift port in partnership with the U.S. military, which is not to enter Gaza. Yet, Netanyahu has recently stated that this dock could help deport Palestinians from Gaza and through which Israel may carry out their mass expulsion. It is also worth mentioning that the wide road that the Zionist regime army is building from the southeast of Gaza City to the sea is geographically consistent with the proposal made by the Zionist regime foreign minister Israel Katz to EU leaders regarding the forced displacement of Palestinians to an artificial island. Moreover, the constant focus on northern Gaza as its own region suggests an international recognition that northern Gaza has become separated from the south. By establishing separate aid distribution structures for the north and south to be managed by the Zionist regime, the international community is ensuring Israel's continued presence and occupation of Gaza. It also means American humanitarian aid may become an extension of the Israeli occupation and its mechanisms of control over Gaza. This project was formed against the backdrop of supporters of Netanyahu government preventing the entry of aid into Gaza through Karam Abu Salem border crossing. Additionally, the political discourse within the Palestinian factions is unrealistic and treats the situation as if conditions were the same as those before October 7th and have not drastically changed. They claim that Palestinians must simply overcome their divisions, even as the Gaza Valley has become a border restricting the movement of Palestinians in Gaza, akin to the apartheid wall in the West Bank. The apartheid wall has drastically changed the political and geographic features of the population in the West Bank. It was constructed on the ruins of the Palestinian urban presence and a population that was forcibly displaced and blocked from the ever returning. In carrying out its plans in Gaza, particularly in the north, the fabricated regime of Israel is securing its lasting occupation of Gaza. Palestinians and Arabs, as well as the international community, should focus their attention on the drastic changes to the geographic and demographic facts on the ground. There needs to be direct Arab pressure on the United States regime to force the Israeli regime to allow humanitarian aid into Gaza through its land borders and not succumb to Israeli government's conditions, as Gaza remains a Palestinian, not an Israeli area. They must further take a firm stance and launch a massive campaign to pressure the Biden administration to stop supplying the Zionist regime with military aid and weapons used to eradicate all elements of basic life in Gaza, while providing inadequate humanitarian assistance, which in fact lacks any humanity. Such outside pressure is necessary, as the Netanyahu government and the opposition alike are blocking all the steps toward a political solution. Meanwhile, as they solidify their occupation in Gaza, they are systematically starving the Palestinian population and committing grave acts that amount to war crimes and deadly acts of genocide, the consequences of which may be more dire than the daily bombings of the city and its people.
Gaza is now an open graveyard with a humanitarian situation that is beyond desperate. This, according to officials in the region. Hello, everyone. Thank you for being with us again. I'm Amina Taylor, and as always, let's kick this edition of Gaza Under Attack off with a quick review of the latest developments. Dozens of Palestinians have been killed in Israeli strikes in the past 24 hours, according to Gaza's health ministry. This as Israel intensifies the bombardment in the south of the besieged enclave ahead of a threatened full-scale attack on Rafah by occupation forces. Tel Aviv has reacted bitterly to the United Nations Security Council issuing its first demand for a ceasefire in Gaza. The U.S. came in for special criticism after Israel's longtime ally abstained during the vote. Israel cancelled the planned visit of a high-level delegation to Washington in retaliation. In an escalation along the border, seven Lebanese and an Israeli were killed in an exchange of fire. Hezbollah says it's launched dozens of rocket strikes in retaliation to Israeli aggression. Now the leader of resistance group Hamas's Ismail Haniyeh said that Israel has failed to achieve all of its strategic and military goals in the ongoing war in Gaza. Haniyeh, in a visit to the Islamic Republic of Iran, made the comments at a news conference in Tehran after meeting the country's foreign minister. In the UK, parliamentarians in pairs have signed a letter urging London to ban arms sales to Israel. This as Britain faces legal action over its decision to pause funding for aid body UNRWA. Since October last year, the death toll in the US-Israeli genocide on Gaza has topped 32,000, with tens of thousands missing and wounded. With us for this edition of the programme, in the studio alongside myself, the journalist and broadcaster Ted Kofi, and with us via Skype from Johannesburg in South Africa, Tsetso Magama. Tsetso is a longtime political activist, and he served in various roles within the African National Congress, the ANC, as well as leading other grassroots movements in South Africa. And he joins us in his capacity as the spokesperson for Africa for Palestine. Welcome to you both. Tet, it seems a real shame every time you are here, and those moments have lasted perhaps longer than anyone of us would like in this capacity. The sheer numbers killed, the sheer brutality, just bring us up to speed with your reaction.
Well, the longer the thing goes, the more clear it becomes that turning the Gaza crisis around is like turning an oil tanker. You spin the wheel, and it'll take a long time for this ship to take traction. But it's gathering momentum all the time. What looks like something that will never stop is actually on its way to cessation. I'm sure about that.
And your own thought, Tsetso, I mean, we mentioned the horrifying statistics there, 32,000 plus killed, 75,000 plus wounded. Just your musings on the scale of this genocidal war on Gaza.
The scale is horrifying. And it's, you know, it's something that we haven't hitherto seen, at least for the past 20 years. You know, excluding, of course, you know, what we've seen in Syria not so long ago. But the fundamental difference this time around is that these atrocities, this genocide and ethnic cleansing is literally taking place on our phones and laptops and televisions. This is unprecedented. And so I think, you know, we have reached in many ways a crossroads to perhaps really as a, not as part of a cliche, but this is really a crossroads because very few people today, you know, have the luxury of denying what many of us have been saying for decades, that there is an ethnic cleansing that has been happening. There is a genocide in various iterations. Of course, nothing that we have seen, you know, thus far. And it's horrifying. But I think what is even more horrifying is the extent to which, you know, leaders in the West have met these atrocities with the kind of apathy that we have seen. Perhaps even more shocking than the babies and women and the elderly and an entire population, and you know, erased from the face of the earth. And so this is one of those unspeakable crimes that I think history will not forgive humanity, you know, for allowing them to continue and continue for such a long time.
Indeed, and just stay with me here to set so, because we see Israel in near global isolation after the U.S. dropped its veto position and abstained during that E10 vote, ensuring that, of course, the other council members would vote in favor of that ceasefire. And we're going to go deeper into this element, but what was your reaction to that almost poetic moment when it was clear, almost visually, that America was saying, listen, we can't continue to support this much longer?
It's not a testament to the U.S. administration, to the Biden administration. It's really a testament to the struggles of the international community, especially the Global South, and indeed the citizens of the Global North, who have been pushing the United States and their governments in the West to, you know, take a step back and review their policy in regard to this ongoing genocide. So really, I think this is the one moment that should give hope to all of us that, you know, with united and consistent action, we will eventually prevail. And so in that context, the Palestinian struggle, you know, in broadly, strategically, will also prevail, not on the basis of you know, a change of heart in the hearts of self-declared Zionists like Joe Biden, the Democratic Party in the U.S. and the Republicans, you know, but really it's going to be a struggle, as the late President Augustino Neto said, the Angolan poet president. He said, no regime can press over the hot lid of a boiling pot forever. And I think we have seen a culmination of that moment.
Indeed. Tet, I'm going to get you to wade in on this after we hear from the Palestinian delegation here, because the dust continues to settle on the move by the UN Security Council to approve a resolution on Gaza demanding an immediate ceasefire and the immediate and unconditional release of all captives. Now, the 10 non-permanent members, the E10 proposed draft, was adopted in a vote, as I mentioned earlier, of 14 in favour and one abstention, that of the United States. The Palestinian permanent representative to the UN gave his reaction after previous ceasefire motions were killed by the US using its veto power.
When such atrocities are being committed in broad daylight against defenseless civilians, including women and children, the right thing to do, the only thing to do morally, legally, politically, is to put an end to it. There can be no justification for war crimes, crimes against humanity, and genocide. Accepting any justification for such crimes is renouncing our humanity and destroying the rule of international law beyond repair. This must be a turning point. This must lead to saving lives on the ground. This must signal the end of this assault of atrocities against our people. A nation is being murdered. A nation is being dispossessed. A nation is being displaced for decades now, but never at this scale since the Nakba.
The Palestinian delegate there, Riyad Mansour, and Tel Aviv did not react well to this. In fact, Netanyahu, just let me get this quote correct, said the U.S. has abandoned its policy at the United Nations and that this move would harm the war efforts and peace talks. Do you think Netanyahu's overplayed his hand slightly here?
I don't think he has, because the whole thing is theatre. I think that everybody knows and understands that the U.S. and the Israeli government under Netanyahu are very close to each other. They are allies. In fact, what is really demonstrative is the fact that by an act of omission, the United States underscored its allyship with the government of Israel when everybody else said it's time for a ceasefire. So, again, this plays to the notion that they don't seem to be reading the fact that people outside, people in the global south have seen this for a long time, but now slowly people in the global north are coming to recognize the depth of the relationship their individual countries and, of course, the United States has with the state of Israel. And it is with the growth of this understanding, especially given the context, that actually our lives in the global north aren't as good as they used to be before. We're all going through a cost of living crisis. Some countries are having terrible shocks with food prices and access to fuel and so on. What this does is that it makes people more empathetic to the suffering of other people. And I don't think that the governments of the United States and many of these countries yet realize how much empathy their people are beginning to buy into what's going on.
Ted Kofi and Tisetso Magama were my special guests, and our thanks to them and, of course, to you for being with us. And until next time, continue to keep Palestine in your hearts.
Imam Ja'far Sadiq, peace be upon him, has said, "Whoever remembers us to Ahlul Bayt and his or her eyes fills with tears, his or her face will never burn in the fire of hell."
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, the reformation of the mind in the holy month of Ramadan in our Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. It is an honor to be here, the holy month of Ramadan. So we are talking about the reformation of the mind in the holy month of Ramadan in our Islamic lifestyle. So, of course, in the holy month of Ramadan, we all know that we are going through a purification process. This purification process, of course, the fundamental aspect of it is this intention that we have, this niyyah, in order to attain nearness to the Almighty Allah. This is the fundamental pillar and the fundamental foundation upon which the rest of our spiritual building is built upon. This intention, of course, for seeking the nearness to the Almighty Allah, it needs to be sincere, it needs to be profound, it needs to be deep in our hearts. And when this intention emanates with sincerity and with thought and with determination and from within ourselves, then this intention is very golden. It is something which becomes very precious. And of course, it is then an intention which brings us truly closer to the Almighty Allah. So that's the fundamental pillar. And then, of course, we add, you know, things to this fundamental pillar of this spiritual building that we are building in the holy month of Ramadan. And those other things are, for example, well, first and foremost, the fasting. Not eating, not drinking, not doing the other jurisprudentially forbidden things which will break our fast, you know, from before the dawn prayers or at the dawn prayers up until the evening and Maghrib prayers. This, of course, adds to that purification factor.
رمضان المستبين جاء بالنور المبين رمضان 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 القانتين.
Welcome back. This is A to Z on IRIB English Radio. So we are talking about the reformation of the mind in the holy month of Ramadan in our Islamic lifestyle. So again, we have to remember that when it comes to our Islamic lifestyle, this reformation of the mind is something that, you know, hopefully, inshallah, Allah willing, is something that will continue through the rest of the year, inshallah. Now, we had said that the fundamental foundation and this fundamental pillar, if you will, of our spiritual building that we are constructing in the holy month of Ramadan is our intention and our niyyah. And after that, we said that, you know, some of the things that are added on are, of course, the fasting from food and drink and the other jurisprudentially forbidden things that can break our fast. Now, the level up from that, of course, with these two things, the blessings of the holy month of Ramadan are such that our mind and our body start to detoxify. In order to reform the mind, we kind of have to plug ourselves off from the various different, you know, social media or television or internet or movies or music or these kind of other, you know, inputs that are harmful for us and have a role in constructing the mind. We have to plug ourselves off from those things, at least in the holy month of Ramadan, limit our usage of these kind of devices so that slowly but surely, you know, with the recitation of the Holy Quran and contemplation over it and the recitation of du'as and, of course, the prayers, slowly but surely we will be able to reform our mind in this holy month of Ramadan. Thank you very much, dear listeners, for listening to this episode of A to Z. Don't forget to visit our website at parsetoday.ir/EN Call of Islam page, where you can find all of our previous programs and many others as well. Until another episode, fi amanillah, and God bless you all.
lift me up high. You spread my wings and fly me to the sky. I feel so alive. It's like my soul thrives in your light. But how I wish you'd be here with me all year around.
Welcome to Have It Out with Galloway. Every single week, I'll be here discussing the hottest topics, the biggest world events, but perhaps from a perspective that you will not find easily on the mainstream media. The question this evening is the UK complicit in the Gaza genocide? Well, as the old joke goes, is the Pope a Catholic? Do bears defecate in the woods? The United Kingdom's not just complicit in the current genocide going on in the Gaza Strip, it is complicit in the entire genocidal story of more than 75 years of the calvary of the Palestinian people. I sit in the British Parliament, where in the very chamber I sit in the very room that I'm in every day, the Palestinian disaster, Nakba, catastrophe, was authored. When the Prime Minister of Britain, on behalf of one people, promised to the Zionist Federation, on behalf of a second people, the land that belonged to a third people. None of the three people concerned were, of course, consulted. And after that Balfour Declaration, more than 100 years ago, we began the descent down the bloody staircase which led us to this disaster today. Now, breaking news. The United Nations Security Council has called for a ceasefire for the month of Ramadan. They hope that it will become a lasting ceasefire. But even a lasting ceasefire implies some kind of event at the end which might return the violence, the massacres, the bloodshed, the torture. The truth is, we don't know at the time of recording if Israel will tell the United Nations Security Council to stick their resolution where the sun don't shine. We don't know what the members of the Security Council will do about it, were that to be the case. It may be that although he's huffing and puffing, the gangster Netanyahu truly wanted this ceasefire to become into effect. It's possible. We can't trust a word any of these actors say. Neither the actors in Israel and not the actors in the Western world, in the presidencies, in the chanceries, in the parliaments of the Western world. It's perfectly possible that all of this has been carefully choreographed. We must pray, of course, that there will be a ceasefire, even for a day or a week of relief from the shot and shell of the Western-backed Israeli occupation force, which has laid waste. Its grim reaper has now taken the lives and the blood of well over 120,000 people who've either been murdered or maimed, mutilated and wounded. Of course, the United Kingdom is complicit within it. The endless overflights of British aeroplanes, Air Force jets from the bases in Cyprus, the selling of weapons from Britain to Israel, the exchange of intelligence information, where Israel is effectively a sixth eye, the five eyes, the white Anglo-Saxon five eyes that dominate the intelligence world, has long been shared with Israel. And in this last 170 days and more, when the catastrophe has reached the depths that it has reached, the five eyes, the six eyes, have been operating as one. And what a sight it has been. All this death, all this destruction, almost unbearable, even for those only watching it on our telephones, and certainly unbearable for the victims, the Palestinian victims. You know, it's coming up for Easter in the Western world, in the Eastern Christian world. It's a time when we think about resurrection. Will the British government, in some kind of act of epiphany, now mend the great crime that it has committed against the people of Palestine? I'm joined tonight, and in fact every week, with a group of distinguished panelists, as well as an interested live studio audience. Our guest tonight, Low Key, is a rapper, a hip-hop artist, an investigative journalist, and his critically acclaimed music has millions of streams on Spotify, over 25,000 digital downloads, and over 45 million YouTube views. Low Key breaks the ground for independent political music. He's also the host of The Watchdog, a podcast on Mint Press News. Dr. Marwa Osman is a journalist and a presenter. She holds a PhD and two masters and is a university lecturer at the Lebanese International University and Maarif University. She hosts and produces political shows, as well as being a writer, with her comments being published by a whole variety of outlets. And Fra Hughes is a journalist, author, and human rights activist from the north of Ireland. He has written several books, including An Activist's Tale, My Walk with Palestine, which chronicles his experiences as an international activist and his involvement with the Viva Palestina 5 medical aid convoy. His work focuses on the role of activism in promoting justice and human rights. And a plethora of interested and interesting audience guests joining us from all over the world who'll be chipping in throughout the show. But let me turn first, if I may, to my good friend, a sage, a seer, a philosopher king. To say he's a rapper and a hip-hop artist, which he is, and a highly successful one, is not even half the story, as you are about to find out if you haven't seen him before. Low Key, thanks for joining us. I suppose it's the most obvious question in the world. Is the UK complicit in the genocide in Gaza? I know that your answer is the same as mine, yes, but to what extent and in what ways is the UK complicit in the genocide in Gaza?
Well, thank you so much, George, for the very kind introduction. I'm certainly not worthy of the praise that you heaped upon me. But to start with, it's important that people are aware that Britain has a secret military agreement which it signed with Israel in 2020. We do not know the details of that agreement, but it's very likely that it stipulates some level of involvement if either side officially enter hostilities. What we do know is the R1 shadow spy plane of the Royal Air Force has been flying almost daily over Gaza, and one of the key specialities of that plane is target acquisition. So it would lead you to believe that there has been some involvement on the side of that. We also know that the RAF has sent over 50 military flights to Tel Aviv from the British base in Akrotiri in Cyprus. We also know that around 9 Israeli military jets have landed in this country throughout the bombing of Gaza. We do not know the details of what was on those flights. We know that the US has used the British bases in Cyprus to transport weapons to Israel. We know that Britain, for example, According to Claudia Webb, Member of Parliament, she stated that Britain has granted 26 arms export licenses to Israel during this time. But what we also know is that from the F-35 to the F-16 to the Apache helicopters to even the sniper rifles that Israel uses, they used in 2018 to squash the Great March of Return, where Palestinians were attempting to exercise their right under UN Resolution 194, that even within the sniper rifles, there are components that come from Britain. There are over 100 companies which function in Britain that are involved in the construction of the F-35 fighter jet, which Israel has used to wreak such devastation over Gaza. So really, we are looking at a picture where it's not clear where British intelligence and Israeli intelligence begins and ends on either side. Britain, Israel, and the United States are very much part of a trilateral security arrangement, which sees key functions of the Israelis outsourced to the British, and also vice versa, key functions of the British outsourced to the Israelis. So unfortunately, I would say the answer to your question is definitely.
Thanks for that. We'll come back to you. Let's take a view from Aisha, who's in London, on our audience wall, a new innovation. Very glad to see you, Aisha. You're the first person to speak from that wall. What would you like to ask?
Hi, George. I wanted to ask you, what do you make of this UN resolution? If Israel does follow the ceasefire for the rest of Ramadan, what will it do, or what do you think would happen in the West Bank, knowing what happened last time during the ceasefire, where they simply upped their aggression and the murders and the violence in the West Bank?
Well, I mean, one possibility is that Israel refuses to heed the UN Security Council resolution, and the Security Council is then forced to take a decision about what it will do in response to that defiance. Or Israel will pretend to be accepting the resolution and, as you put it, merely displace their activity, switch the Murdar Incorporated from Gaza to Jerusalem to the West Bank. And what will the Security Council do then? I think that Biden abstaining on the motion is a significant thing. I don't, on balance, believe Israel wanted him to abstain. I think they wanted him to veto it. But time will tell if it's all some macabre dance of death. But the fact that the resolution passed at all, with Britain voting in favor, it's been abstaining for the last 170 days. The fact that Britain voted for a ceasefire is a tribute to each and every protester, demonstrator, boycotter, letters to the editor, everybody who's ever done anything to stand up against this genocide can take some credit for forcing the British government into the position that it took today. Let me go on to our second guest and introduce her to you, Dr. Marwa Osman, journalist, academic, and activist, presenter on television, and very widely read writer. Dr. Marwa joins us from Lebanon. Dr. Marwa, what's your take on the question we're posing and on the Security Council resolution?
Thank you for having me on your show, George, and condolences to my brothers and sisters in Palestine for the grave loss of human souls in this past 6 months. And let me start from your last question and then go to your first. The UN resolution was a bit of something anticipated by many, but a lot suspicious by others as well, like me. I'm very suspicious about how this is going to be implemented in Gaza, whether or not Israel is going to comply with this temporary ceasefire. And I have a lot of questions as to why now, how come the U.S. Decided to abstain from the vote, and what is the result going to be mirrored on the ground, whether the Israeli entity will comply or not, whether they will be sending the delegation to Washington or not. A lot of questions, but especially why now? It's a very big question. And whether or not this is just for show, because if you look at the points in that ceasefire, there some of them are really very hard to implement if you're going to just talk about Israeli captives and not talk about the Palestinian hostages, more than 8,000 Palestinian hostages.